Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
It's the Shortcoat Podcast, and I'm Dave Ettler, and we bring you the world of medicine and medical education as seen from an oblique angle. Nearly edge on, while blurring our eyes slightly so that the details are obscured a bit, and you're not overwhelmed. We don't want you to be overwhelmed, do we, Aline?
Nope, never.
That's right, we don't. This is medicine light. We enlighten, yes, we educate.
Mm-hmm.
But we're sort of like the Brian Williams of podcasts.
Ooh.
Sometimes we misremember. And hope that no one will notice.
Sometimes the Drew Pinsky.
Whoa, hello. He's the whole reason I'm here right now.
Oh, wow.
Ooh, nice.
He is my everything.
But never mind then, never mind. Today, in addition to Aline, we've got Cole Chaney.
Hello.
Greg Woods.
Hi there.
And special guest, Reed Wilson.
How's it going?
Reed Wilson is a physical therapy student here at the Carver College of Medicine, right?
Correct.
And the founder, a founder? Of Second Shot. Reed, what's Second Shot?
Second Shot is an adaptive outdoor program where we take people pheasant hunting and bass fishing. So anyone with an illness or disability, we take them out, and then we pair that with adopted hunting dogs that we train ourselves.
What do you want to accomplish?
We want to give highlight that there's opportunity after an injury or illness, and display their story through video and media.
All right, so tell me about the type of people that come seeking recreational second shot help.
Sure. Anyone with disability or illness really qualifies if they're just looking to do an adaptive activity. So we've had a spinal cord injury patient at the C4 level that can only move his finger. So that was one of our patients, and we have a cancer client as well so far. So that was a little easier logistically, fortunately. But we try to get it done for anyone, no matter their needs. So the first one was in a wheelchair, and we put him in a UTV and drove him around the pheasant property and was able to get him on some birds.
And does this take place around here in Iowa? Or?
This takes place right now, right here locally for now. We've had some fortunate help with sponsors, one of them being Highland Hideaway, which is a pheasant reserve. So they set us up with a great amount of land to operate on. But we will be traveling in the future to some locations this fall, which will be exciting.
Tell us about the PT training and how this incorporates into what you're doing.
Sure. So a lot of physical therapy is just getting people back to a functional level or out to what they'd like to do, whether that be exercises around the house, activities of daily living, ADL is a popular term. But it really comes down to what do they want to do. And a lot of people want to get back outside or want to find an activity after an injury. So whether they were past outdoors men or women or just wanting to start, it's a great activity for bonding purposes, getting them moving. So, for example, with Chris, he's in a wheelchair. We have to move that all around. He has to get in and out of it. We help him hold the gun. We'll be helping someone hold a fishing rod this summer. So it gets their hands moving, fingers moving. They're turning all day. We're out for 4 hours, however long they want to be. So it's therapy throughout the whole day, which is nice and a very fun format.
That's fantastic. I'm just curious how you got the idea for this. Was there a personal experience that motivated you, or you just wanted to do something really kind?
Excuse me. So a few blending of factors that started. A couple years ago, I saw a fishing show where a professional fisherman took out a veteran with no legs and made it a completely normal fishing experience for him. And they wheeled his wheelchair right out on the deck of a bass boat, and it was slick. And I had actually deferred a year from therapy school, and I said, that's the therapy I want to be doing eventually. So then I adopted two dogs this summer, and we trained them to hunt. Unfortunately, one broke his leg, and he was sitting next to me, and the moment happened when he looked up at me, and he looked kind of sad, and he'd been sitting for 3 weeks. So he had that look in his eye that says, let's get back to this. He had been sad for the last couple weeks. So we knew our friend Chris, who was a wheelchair guy, and he wants to get out and hunt, so let's pair the two. Called my friend Jordan Graham and said, let's do this, and he said, let's do this. So we got it set up about 3 weeks later, and we were off on our first pursuit, is what we like to call them.
That's awesome. That's a great story.
So I know hunting seems to be the primary focus. You mentioned fishing. Mm-hmm. What else are you guys working on?
Sure. So those are the two activities we focus on. We're happy to take anyone and really any outdoor activity. If they suggest something, that's fine. But we'll do Pheasant hunting and then bass fishing are the two. And then our big project is a lot of video. So we film everything on GoPro. We have things mounted to dogs, wheelchairs, guns. So it has a lot of perspective. And then we have 4 or 5 volunteers per suit that follow us and get a lot of media. We probably have 10 hours of media per hunt, per pursuit. And then we have a video guy who edits it. So we're working on those videos right now. We have a couple done and a third one done. Third one will be done shortly. So showing the story through video has been a big value and will be a big key in the future to share what's possible.
I'm gathering from looking at the video that I saw, which is on Vimeo, and I'll post a link on the website.
Post it in a week.
In 1 week?
Yeah, the live launch, yeah.
I don't wanna get, well, coincidentally, the show will be posted.
All right.
The dogs play a big part in this. You know, more so than, I don't know. I mean, the dogs are obviously hunting dogs, but at the same time, they play a big part in the therapy aspect of it too, I suspect.
Yep, that's correct. So there's a lot of research, I guess this is evidence-based listeners, that shows that animals are very therapeutic. So whether you're in finals week or whether you're coming home from a long day, petting a dog has been shown to help a lot. And then we all know there are therapy dogs out there. So we're using them in that aspect. It was pretty neat. Our first client, Chris, came out. We lifted him off his van and he was in his wheelchair, and we let out one of our dogs, Nellie, who's a black lab and really does not care for men all that much. She's pretty skittish, as I think Cole knows. So she jumps down and jumps right up on Chris and gives him a big hug. And then they were hugging, and but then Chris's assistant leaned forward and she barked at him and backed off. So she was very, very, she had an allegiance to Chris immediately. And he really, really enjoyed that. Just feeling that on his hand, which don't function like yours or mine to feel something and have, part of the thing with the dogs is it gives someone control that doesn't have a lot of control. So all our dogs are trained to 3 whistles. They come in on 3 whistles, they sit on 1 whistle, and they continue hunting on 2. So if the client wants to experience that, it's like a magic trick if you haven't done it for a dog before. So they don't have control in their daily life completely like you or I, but they can control their experience with the dog. So it does play an enormous part in that fashion.
Do you find it all, it's sometimes challenging to get these people out to embrace these experiences? I could see being almost hesitant at a certain point. Mm-hmm. Do you find that, or are they just eager to go out?
We haven't found that so far. The 2 clients we've had have been, well, I should back up a little bit. They've been excited for the experience, but they have their hesitancies as I haven't done this before. There's the dangers of guns and dogs, and if you don't know how to handle those things, they are dangerous. If you do know how to handle those things, they're very safe and a great tool that allows us to be living today. So we go through a very complete safety hour with all the volunteers, with all the clients, and we shoot on a range first with coaching, and we're doing something called dry fire. There's no bullets in the gun. So we make the experience, you know, you wouldn't, if you're a pro snowboarder, you didn't start off jumping 60-foot jumps. You start on tiny ones. So we start out with nothing in there, make them comfortable holding the gun, make them comfortable loading the gun, make them comfortable aiming the gun without anything in it, make them comfortable aiming with something in it. So it's a nice transition to get rid of some of those hesitancies. And then there's always the fear of, will I hit anything? Will I disappoint this group? Well, the first thing Jordan and I said was, we are very successful just by having someone out here that's not normally out here. So we don't need to connect on any game. We're just going to have a good time. Well, then we thought our hardest clientele would be someone like Chris, who's in a wheelchair. Well, he ended up hitting 4 birds on his own. So we knew it was very possible after that to have, we always say a great hunt's a safe hunt. Well, we had a great hunt and we had a safe hunt. So getting over some of those initial hesitancies has been, I guess, a challenge, but a very solvable challenge.
In terms of a time commitment, because you're also doing physical therapy stuff right mm-hmm. now as well, how will that work moving forward in terms of being able to keep this year-round or do this more often?
Sure. So right now we're on weekends, and we've only done 2 so far, and we have a third one coming up. And our hope is this fall to at least go every other weekend. So the weekend time, I'm fine with doing it. It turns into about an 18-hour work day, but that's fine. It's well worth it. We go and we pick up a truck from a dealer who sponsors us, and we shake hands down at Highland every time. Every part of it's rewarding, even though it's exhausting. And then after the hunt, we cook a meal with our fresh game and do some recipes, laughter, and whatnot. So the weekends will let us keep it up. And then we're actually hoping to move this into a thing where we have at least one employee, it might be me, who's doing it half the week. We're raising enough funds to have them as an executive director. and then we're able to take someone out during the week and on the weekend and make it a more consistent therapy practice, you might say.
You know what I love about this is that, at least from your perspective, it's something you might be doing anyway, you know, as sort of in your, you know, as a hunter maybe. And you get to sort of integrate this into your life, mm-hmm. Even more than if it was, you know, sort of quote, just a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool. I mean, who wouldn't want that sort of arrangement?
Yeah, I think we all have that spoken to us at some point. People have terms like make your vocation your vacation or find the perfect blend. I like one where my friend, he always draws three circles. And so like mine, I like to blog, I like to do therapy, I like to be outdoors. So I draw those three circles. And I might not be the best at any one of those three, but that I put the three together and you try to be the best right in the middle. And that's kind of your vocation. I like that example because it's not necessarily really dreamy. It's pretty objective and says, I do these three things and let's put them together. So it happened to, I would say, merge for me at this point. It would have been a long time searching for that point. So everyone goes through that at some point, I think.
Or would like to.
Or would like to. Maybe that's a good way to say it. So we're finally getting there where, it's therapy mixed with outdoors, and that's, I guess, would you say a dream come true, even though it's a lot of hard work. So
The medical aspect of this, too, is that the surgeon goes in and maybe works on the knee and says, well, how many degrees of extension and flexion do you have? And the PT might ask, actually, like, can you walk up your stairs? I think it's a very interesting, this is what we need to be doing more, is are you able to function on a day-to-day basis? Even if the metrics are there or the labs are there, you know, the bigger question is, can you live this life you want to live? I mean, would you say that's part of this?
Yes, absolutely. And that's where one of our biggest commitments to this is sharing a story. And I steal that from a career advisor. She always said, share your story. Don't tell people what you do. Show it. So we want to show their story through video and through content online and do a lot of work that way to show what's possible, what they want to do, what they want to achieve versus, sometimes in my role as a physical therapist, we do get hung up in degrees of flexion, degrees of extension. Well, that's great and all, but if I can't reach the cup of sugar, I'm not going to bake very good cookies. So they want to get to that point, and then translating that to the outdoors is someone wants to get back outdoors or to say this is something I want to get started, because it's very possible when you lose your legs, you're not going to be dunking a basketball like you used to. You might be able to do wheelchair basketball, or you can come out and go fishing or shoot a gun with us, and it's very satisfying. I mean, it's caveman-like activities or cavewoman. So it's very intrinsic to do these things and very enjoyable for most people once they learn a nice, safe way to handle the situation. So, yeah, we're trying to show the therapeutic possibility through it.
I have never fired a gun before.
Well, we'll take you out.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious. You've had two clients so far, you said. Was this something they hadn't done before?
They hadn't pheasant hunted before. Both had shot a gun before.
Okay.
And so shotgun shooting, for those who don't know, the target's moving. There's clay pigeon flies out for practice and you shoot a pattern of BBs come out of a shell, which can be a foot wide at a good range where you want to hit something, and then it keeps spreading from there. So it's a moving target, which makes it challenging, and people think, I can't do this. But it's rather instinctive after about 10 shots, and the less you think, the more you are able to hit something. So with Chris, he's a little tricky because he can only move his left middle finger. So I was actually down on the barrel taking a lot of heat. A lot of trash talk was found in those videos afterwards away from me. So I would swing the barrel for him and then say fire, and he would pull the trigger. So we had that practice, but you can hear my partner Jordan over there, he has a GoPro on his chest. He said, "Yeah, you can't hit." Bad word. Not sure if you're allowed on here. And I hear him say, "He's gonna make me come over and shoot if I keep saying stuff." But we, about the 10th one, we hit one, and people went nuts. And actually, some of the more, I would call them professional hunters and guides, were watching, like, seeing what are we doing with the wheelchair over there, and they cheered over there, and people really got a kick out of it. So, yeah, they hadn't done it before, but after a few shots, you get it, and then. It's to pheasant hunting. The reason we chose that, you can walk and you can talk while you do it. And then you have what's called a pointing dog, which points a bird. It doesn't kick it up. And then the humans go and make the bird fly up. So it allows us to set a person up for a decent shot. And it's such a team effort, which is nice. So if you don't hit it or you don't hit all of it, someone else will hit it, and it feels like we all hit it together, and we're all eating dinner together later.
And the food's often the best part, too, regardless of the success of the hunt.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And you can always go hunt at Fairway afterwards if you really fail. But to your point there, we love our pheasant poppers afterwards, which are awesome. Yeah, you know what those are. Yeah, bacon, and we spiced them up recently. We went bacon, little bit of cream cheese, pepper jack cheese, green chili, the pheasants dipped in a teriyaki marinade, then we roll that up and toothpick it.
Darn, that's really good.
I'll give you a little photo after this, but it's really taking things up a notch. Then we do some sweet potato fries and some famous secret recipe brownies.
This is so exotic. I'm not from Iowa, but
I had no idea.
Yeah. Well, you guys are you're welcome on the next one. So
I will take you up on that. Yeah, I love food and company.
How do we find you? Give us what's the plug for the
second
shot.
Sure. So you can find us on getsecondshot.com. And the official web launch is February 20th. We do have a beta version ready, and it's pretty neat. We have some good development talent. I kind of chopped my way through to help people on that, but we have a good developer. And we have a lot of content on dog training, hunting and fishing tips, and then adaptive therapy, what that means for health and outcomes. And then all our videos will be on there. We have some comedy, some serious hunt videos, some dog training videos again. So you can find us on there and be part of the community. There's a place where you can sign up for membership, and we have a pretty neat menu of options. It looks like a cafe menu, so it's kind of fun. And one of our biggest values as far as sponsorship and membership is we believe in giving something. When people hand over money, it's like, what am I investing in? So for companies, we thought, what can we do for them? So we write content for them, for their customers, and we put them on our truck with a sticker and make sure to pan them, because it's just not possible without them. And then for individual members, we have second shot quarter zips and polos and t-shirts, and someone designed us a really nice logo. So fun to wear around, and you get our cookbook along with the membership. So it's fun.
You guys are big time.
Well,
you guys are pretty well organized.
Yeah, man.
Thank you.
I'm impressed.
Thank you.
So at this point, who are your, are there any sponsors you want to call out right now?
Sure. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Like I said, our biggest value is sponsor relationships and people that want to grow with us. So our new one that's just really exciting is for the Iowa community is Mark Ironside, who runs Ironside Apparel in Cedar Rapids. He's a two-time national champ for Iowa late 90s. And that was funny going in there. He was sizing me up for the first 5 minutes. It was probably the mustache. He was nervous about it.
I was going to ask you about that.
I actually
golfed with him back at Westwood when they had that wrestling tournament years ago.
Good.
And he was an awesome guy.
He's awesome.
Yeah.
He rode the Grand Gable, a 100-mile bike ride on a mountain bike he found, I think, on the street, as the story goes. It could be a fable by now, but he's one of them. He's doing our apparel. And then we have Highland Hideaway, who's our pheasant reserve, where we go competing against each other right now. Billion Auto and McGrath Auto have both given us a truck, so that's been good.
Wow.
Yeah, for pursuit days only now.
That's fantastic.
You need to work with Shortcoat Podcast. We're not big on the sponsorship game right now. We need to up them.
Then we do.
We'll take some lessons from you. Maybe we should, I don't know, be cooler or something.
No. It's
what are you
fantastic.
Trying to say?
I don't know.
I think you guys are very cool. This whole setup is unbelievable.
That's very
sweet.
Think
you're really cool.
Well, thanks. When you said launch, I met a guy at a startup weekend in Sioux Falls, and I had presented. This idea was going to happen no matter what. So at a startup weekend, you present ideas, and I showed this off, and no one voted for it. And that's fine. I'm going to do it anyways. But this guy mysteriously comes up to me and says, "Hey, I'm John. I have money, time, and development talent. You should do this." And he made me pitch it to him again. He's like, I like this. So he came down. He came down for the first hunt, and he said, "What you should do is do grassroots style. Don't go out and tell everybody. Get some content up. Do a good job planning it. Build it up. Get a couple hunts in, and then launch it." So that's why we've waited. We've taken his advice, and he has sound advice. So we want to make it a really big deal for these clients, because it's like both of them said, "I didn't think it was possible for me to go hunting. You have opened a door, and I love it." One guy's coming back next fall. We're doing a crowdfunding effort for him to help him with a foundation. That's why we've waited on the launch. But we're ready to go February 20th, and then we speak at Prairie Meadows at an event February 21st. So
fantastic.
It's awesome.
Very good. We'll be back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
Hey, look at us. We're back.
There are some places that you really do want to avoid, like the plague. And for you, Dave, I thought this would be interesting because you lived
because
in New York.
Because we would like to avoid you.
Because, well, I didn't say that directly, okay. But you lived in New York for a while.
Yes.
And last week, a story came out that said that people had gone around to some 240 of the different stops for the underground in New York and did swabs to see what the bacteria levels were there. And the findings were a little bit disconcerting. Amongst them, they actually found traces of the plague and dysentery and all these other terrible diseases. They also looked at the DNA signatures and found that there were some 15,000 types of life forms that they were able to swab from all of these different locations. 562 types of bacteria, 67 of which could be very dangerous to humans. The good thing is they weren't found in strong enough levels to make people sick. But the fact that they're down there at all, I think, is a little bit worrying.
Where was this?
New York City.
Where exactly in New York? Was it just like something was excavated?
Many stops. On
yeah, the Transit Authority, they went around to, it's actually 466 different stops all around the subway to try to find different surfaces to swab.
When I lived in New York, briefly, there were these, it seemed like every year they came out with this news story. You know, we went and swabbed the handles on the subway and we found, you know,
traces of poop.
Exactly. So it's nice to see that they're upping their game to include, deadly diseases and not just E. coli.
You bring up an interesting point though with the numbers, right? Any infectious disease expert will tell you the three factors: virulence, number of bacteria, and then the immunocompetence of the host.
True.
So, I think
Dr. Denson for the win.
Right? Come on, that was good.
Who was just here a little bit ago.
Yeah, oddly enough. Maybe I was channeling him. Anyway, but this is interesting because we do have these bugs that are present, but perhaps not in the numbers.
Well, they're everywhere.
But what's the other factor? Maybe an immuno-incompetent person comes across them. It wouldn't be very good.
One thing you want to keep note of, a lot of people took the story and ran with it, I think a little bit too much, because they said a lot of these genomes were not known to man. So on the surface, that can be a little bit scary, but the fact is we really haven't mapped all that many genomes, so don't read too much into that. Heck, we don't even have the cockroach genome and a bunch of kind of simple things that we would consider. So just because we don't know what it is doesn't mean that it's super bizarre, although if you've been to New York,
it's pretty smelly.
It could be bizarre.
It's a pretty bizarre place.
All right, I got a fat tax story.
Oh, come on.
Oh, okay. Did I steal yours?
No. Okay. Go for it.
So Puerto Rico has an obesity crisis. It's even higher childhood obesity than when you compare to the United States, which is hard to do. and so lawmakers are actually pushing a bill that are actually sponsored by the senator to find parents of obese childs. So first off, they will have to go through a consultation through the school.
Obese childs?
Obese childs are in the obese children. And so first they have to undergo a consultation through the school in which they evaluate the diet plan, the activity, maybe familial. Perhaps the child has a genetic problem. Mm-hmm. We don't want to find these people.
Right.
But after that, if the child's condition does not improve after 6 months, the parents could be fined $500, and the fine can go up to as much as $800 if the third progress report after another 6 months has failed. So in other words, it's a progressively increasing tax as the child continues to be obese. What do we think?
How does this factor in with thyroid problems and things like that?
Anything that is what would we call that? Primary obesity?
But what if you don't know at that point?
Well, that's why you go through the evaluation.
That's included in the evaluation.
That's
then.
The primary okay. evaluation, yes. And I'm not sure if it's a full workup, but they do take into account like genetic history, family history, okay. et cetera. But you're right. There's definitely, you're going to miss some, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's...
And for genetic history, I mean, some of that's kind of expensive. Mm-hmm. Where does the cost come from for
that's
this?
That's an interesting point. I don't know.
I think genomic analyses right now run between like $1,000 and $2,000,
so
which seems expensive
for a lot of kids. Yeah,
yeah. But 10 years ago, I think it was like you know, $20,000.
But what do we? But we're deviating.
I think that's idiotic.
to tax people for this.
I think that's absolutely. I think that's absurd. I mean, because you know, as much as I would, you know, say that it's, you know, the intent to decrease childhood obesity is a noble one. I think it completely ignores the fact that we don't know at this point what is causing such a you know, great increase in obesity around the world. I mean, you know, everybody loves to say Americans are, you know, fat. But the truth is, yeah, I mean, maybe, you know, we're the, you know, canary in the coal mine, but the fact that it has become so common, I think is not explained fully yet by, you know, calories in and calories out.
I agree with Dave. I think there's a lot of research right now that's pointing to basically the proportion of certain microorganisms in your gut versus a proportion of other microorganisms that may actually dispose you to, you know, having less leptin produced. And so you sense fullness kind of later on. And that's totally out of your control. That really has to do with diet. And then following up on that point, the other question is, do they account for your poverty level? Because a lot of people in our country are obese because, you know,
there's
they
a
have,
huge link.
Yeah, they have to stretch the value of food stamps. And typically the cheapest food is the junkiest food. And that's not, really, in my opinion, it's not their fault. But I think
you buried the lead with the microbiome. What's our favorite topic there? How do you cure it?
Fecal transplants.
Poop pills. Yep, that's always.
Which, by the way, if we're done with that topic, I have a segue. I have an
awkward
segue.
Wasn't that in the news?
It was. It was. In fact, medical students, you may be flushing tens of thousands of dollars down the toilet each year. Nonprofit Open Biome is willing to pay $13,000 a year for your poop.
Is that for real?
It's for real.
Don't toy with my emotions. I'm deeply in debt already.
There are some caveats. First of all, I think this is a clear sign that fecal transplants are becoming mainstream as Open Biome ships the frozen stool around the country for patients suffering from C. diff infections at the moment. So far, they've shipped about 2,000 doses to 185 hospitals around the country. So donors get $40 a sample with a $50 bonus for donating 5 days a week.
That's a very regular donor.
I mean,
wow.
That's what I call it anyway. So, the process of being selected as a donor is not trivial. Donors have to be completely healthy, like superb health. Open Biome only accepts 4% of the donors who've expressed interest, during the past years. And also you have to live near their Medford, Massachusetts office. Many donors are sourced from the gym next door. So I guess that's nice for them.
What does the federal government have to say about this? Is this at all regulated? Like, I know that there was a big debate about how to classify this material. Did we ever, like, get a resolution about that? Or
we can classify it as kind of gross. But, I don't know.
But effective. Gross, but effective.
Gross, but effective. I haven't the slightest...
The C. diff cure trial was... It was a phase 2 FDA trial, and it was going so well, they actually pulled it off the trial. Like, so it's...
So they expedited it.
Yeah, they expedited it. It was that good, I know. So it might be opposite of what we think in terms of yanking this. You know, it's getting positive reviews, I guess.
Okay.
On a side note, this Massachusetts thing, Dave and I both lived in Massachusetts for a little bit. When I was on the train, I remember there was these flyers for sperm banks, and top dollar could be had if you were a tall Harvard graduate. I remember that was like the big deal there. And this thing had these like books and like it'd have a picture of this tall strapping guy with an Ivy League degree, and that, you know, that got top dollar. And so I wonder if maybe this follows suit in the fecal department.
I don't know if the content is,
I will totally
your bias
linked
to
Ivy
intelligence
guys.
And things, but
well, that's okay. How it used to go. Yeah, when you went to I mean, not from personal experience, but yeah, when you went to, if you wanted to get some donor specimen, yeah, they had binders, and then you could go through the person's resume and yada, yada, yada. And I don't see why it would be any different. I mean, everyone wants to be associated with success. And why would it?
I want successful poop and sperm in my life.
You know, yeah. I'm not saying I would do it. I'm not saying that I understand.
Aline in particular has to be very careful.
I have
of
very
that.
Successful bowels. Yeah. I am proud of that.
Nope. I get all those needs filled already. No problem.
Good.
Can you cut that?
No. He's not allowed. Corey's
not
allowed to
cut that. I know where you live. You need to edit that.
You do?
I will. I'm resourceful.
Well, that's very good. We've spoken many times about junk science here on the show. Mm-hmm. And that preoccupation shows no signs of letting up, at least on my part. So when I learned this week about the seedy underbelly of the world of scientific journalism, I kind of had to bring it up. That is, journals that solicit papers offering to publish them for a fee. Fast Company had a article that reports an experiment by Harvard researcher Mark Schreim, an MD who is pursuing a PhD in health policy. And his email, apparently his email is, every week sort of contains these pitches from open access medical journals promising to publish his research for $500. So he decided to see what happens if he tried it. He crafted a well-designed study, the title of which was Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, The Surgical and Neoplastic Role of Cacao Extract in Breakfast Cereals. Schreim wrote the article with his collaborators at www.randomtextgenerator.com, and he submitted it to 37 journals, 17 of which so far have accepted it, at least as of the publication of that article. It hasn't been published yet because he hasn't sent in his $500 processing fee. So what are we? Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's obvious problems with this model.
Really? Yeah. So there's actually like a huge underground black market counterfeit research journal environment out there.
Yeah.
And one thing that I read, I remember in The Economist, like way back when, there was an article about the research journal black market in China. Because, of course, you know, it's a government system, and the way to advance in your career as a scientist is you have to demonstrate that you have a lot of publications. And they don't even double check sometimes. It's not even the quality of the journal, just like the discrete number of publications that you have. So knowingly or unknowingly, you have a lot of people who submit papers to journals that look 100% legit, but they're totally counterfeit.
Yeah, like the according to the article, the journals often target doctors and researchers from developing countries. Who've been for whatever reason shut out of the legitimate publications, maybe because they do their work at a university no one's ever heard of.
Yeah.
And their names are often pretty similar to legitimate journals, you know, substituting, you know, global for, you know, the
American
word American or something like mm-hmm. that. And it's really hard to tell at a glance that other than the fact that they're going to charge you money to publish.
I'm not going to lie. I get hit up with those emails quite a lot.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you did research. And,
I'm on a few papers, and last year there was a kind of a higher profile one, and it got my name out there, and I get not a ton, but like probably one or two a month. Mm-hmm. And it's people offering to interview me or, you know, publish the paper in a different journal, right. Which is totally unethical, by the way. But
Most people, I think, from this part of the world anyway, pay closer attention to journals listed in PubMed, for instance. But there are actually plenty of reputable journals that aren't listed there. The process of getting your journal listed there is actually very slow and sort of arduous. Perhaps as it should be, but
there is a scoring system that exists where it's degrees of separation from what, do you know what that's called? I can't remember.
I don't remember the algorithm, but it's literally, like, these are government employees. You're talking about PubMed specifically, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Like, these are people who, like, literally sit and read the paper and come up with index search terms and mesh terms, and, like, they manually index all these papers. So if your paper is available online, like, it happens a lot where it's available online before it's actually, like, in print or in PubMed itself. But yeah, it's a person who sits there and does that.
One day I will craft the perfect paper, which is about cancer, diabetic, smoker. You know, it's going to have 15 buzzwords.
Hit all of the...
Yes, I think that's like the top three, but then there's a couple others. We're going to craft this paper.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the most read paper of all time. But we'll work on it. That'll be something in later shows.
It sounds like a good project.
Yeah.
You'll get
many of those junk emails. Man, they'll be wanting to publish you everywhere.
I'll be famous.
Like that one guy we talked about who got a Rhodes Scholarship and apparently did not.
That's in parentheses. The only other story I saw was the fact that Ebola is actually still alive and transmittable 1 week after you are dead, after you die from it.
Yikes.
Which is horrifying. So this sort of opens up, I think, a lot of from the article, from what I've seen before, people have done these interesting ways to bury the bodies where, you know, they're encased in cement, they're buried, they're put into these very unique, desolate places. But that being said, maybe some other third world countries aren't necessarily disposing of an Ebola-infested body the way you need to. So, thought that was an interesting story. One week's a long time.
On the plus side, the number of Ebola cases has drastically declined to the point where they're actually not able to, in some cases, not able to find enough subjects for vaccine trials. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's good news, except that, you know, we still are not quite without an effective vaccine, but okay.
I know. Yeah. This vaccine thing, I feel like that'll be the recurring, well, this will become the vaccine podcast at a certain point.
We're sort of getting
there. No kidding. I wanted to follow up on Cole's point, though. So apparently, like paramedics are instructed to do is, you know, when someone is identified as being infected, you take them in the ambulance and then you directly go to the hospital. However, if they die on the way to the hospital, they're aware that like this is the most infectious period. So they're instructed to directly stop, like dig a hole and bury the person right there. And the problem is that in a lot of countries where you don't have good communication infrastructure, this contributes to like a huge fear among the people of having their loved ones hauled off, because if they die before they get to the hospital and then your loved ones get to the hospital, you're like, well, where is my, and they'll be like, I'm sorry, they're buried somewhere on the side of the road. So it like hugely stigmatized even like going to the hospital, alerting someone to the fact that you're infected.
Seems like a well thought out policy there.
It is, but then how do you explain that to the locals who view death in a less pragmatic way?
In a very
way.
Different way, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have read something about HIV rapid testing, which has gotten inexpensive over the years. But the test can be inaccurate and difficult to interpret. I have not had the occasion to have to read for a different kind of test, a pregnancy test. But I hear that they can be difficult to read. And the paper-based ones for HIV are similarly difficult to read because it relies on, you know, sort of interpreting color-coded results. I'm colorblind, so that doesn't really work for me. And so they can be difficult to make sense of. Now, a team of biomedical engineering researchers at Columbia have released their study of a smartphone accessory that detects HIV with a pinprick, and it delivers results in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's as good at detecting HIV as the most accurate tests currently available, the fancier, you know, laboratory tests. Their hope is that it will be cheap enough and good enough to make a significant impact on the spread of AIDS around the world. So far, testing has been limited with a small group of less than 100 patients from clinics in Rwanda, but results are promising. The device apparently can also detect syphilis, and they hope WHO will one day approve it for use around the world. It costs $34.
Can I be the devil's advocate here?
Yeah.
I feel like there kind of already is a very effective way to stop HIV, and it's don't have unprotected sex.
Yeah.
Like, don't spread it. It's not something you breathe. You don't just, like, randomly trip and fall into someone and accidentally have sex and give them HIV.
But I think the problem is, though, that isn't the problem more that, you know, especially in developing countries, you may not know.
Yep.
That you have the virus.
Or you know, and there's just like a lot of superstitious ideas about how to cure yourself, like having sex with a virgin, which is completely...
Mm-hmm. I had not heard that.
Yeah, that's...
That doesn't sound like a good idea.
Yeah, in Tanzania also, I mean, not to single out any specific countries, but in Tanzania...
but I'll do that anyway.
Which I do. Corey, can you get that? So
I think you're abusing the intern.
Intern?
So, starting from this point. So, in some countries, I think it's the belief that if you consume body parts from someone who is an albino, it may cure you of a variety of ailments, including HIV. So there's a lot of superstition around how to actually treat and cure HIV.
One of the interventions that's been really good, on the other hand, has been the United States has implemented a obligatory testing in that you actually have to opt out of testing. Should the primary care physician identify you as a high-risk group, I think pregnant, I think there's one other stipulation, but I can't remember. But in other words, he's going to test unless you ask otherwise, which at first I think actually seems kind of paternal and forceful. But on the flip side, it comes at no harm to you. And so it's actually worked really well in reducing HIV transmission rates and also the knowledge of it. So I think this is an interesting policy for other things. For example, if you come in and you complain of hypertension, maybe your eyes feel kind of weird and you're obese, they'll probably test you for diabetes without saying, can I test you for diabetes? And we've now done it with AIDS. It seems to be working really well. So I don't know how we maybe expand this to a third world context, because it is totally different, but it seems to work.
I mean, I definitely think it's a wonderful idea, and I'm really glad that that's happening.
I like to bring these things up. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think we should also, at the same time, continue throwing money in the direction of, like, improving education and understanding, you know, how science works and how your health works, for example.
Fair enough. I just like to bring these things up because what intrigues me about these devices that people are making is that they're utilizing, so the key here is that they are utilizing the smartphone as a computational engine for this, you know, relatively inexpensive doodad that hooks into it. So, you know, in the past you had to take you know, the blood sample, send it off to a lab that had the computational ability, the equipment to look at the sample and, you know, decide what's in there. Well, now we've got it in our pockets. And so, you know, that's the key difference.
Yeah. Now
which
that
I think, which I think is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Now that I'm, off my soapbox, I think that is really cool. Actually, that is like objectively a really cool way to capitalize on a technology that everyone just carries around.
It's strange that even in, you know, these developing countries that these devices are still have a significant, if not ubiquitous, because they're not ubiquitous, but, you know, significant penetration. Yeah. So
the fact that now we have a computational device that also has its own power source and its ability to transmit, and
right,
it's becoming more popular, so more people are getting it. Yeah, it's a wonderful resource to have.
Greg, you just blew my mind.
I don't think about that. Yeah.
The angels live in it, and then send your information to an angel living in the sky, and then it comes to other angels.
Instantaneously. You know that like 50% of Americans believe in angels, so yeah. You just offended a lot of our listeners. I mean,
Corey,
just
kidding. Or angels that listen. They're angry too.
We have a significant angel our listener angel. Population.
I want to end on an uplifting note, for me at least. I don't know why that's
what
funny,
are you into?
But
that's all right.
You know, I'm
we're laughing because you're laughing.
Well, several weeks back, we talked about the mental state of surgeons and also how appealing they are. But sometimes I think they maybe miss the mark a little bit. Andy Grant is a 26-year-old UK war vet who recently had a severe injury from an IED that resulted in the amputation of his leg below the knee. Well, he's since gone on to go through all kinds of rehabilitation, and he's back to running and actually climbing. But the irony is, he's a Liverpool football fan, so one of the songs that they sing before their games, going back to the late 50s, is "You'll Never Walk Alone." So he had a tattoo of that on his leg, but ironically, the surgeons chose to cut off that last word so that his tattoo now reads, "You'll Never Walk." So he has defied them with thousands of hours of all this stuff, and is now actually 2 minutes away from setting an amputee record for a 10K. He's currently running sub 40-minute 10Ks as a result, and he's also been doing harder and harder climbing routes. So he's getting back into it, but you have to wonder, now what is the procedure for something like that? I'd love to hear from surgeons on this.
Do you think they did it on purpose?
I don't know if they did, unless they were a Manchester football fan.
I mean, it's not like they just go in there and like they're like, closing their eyes and whacking it off. Don't they draw like literally dotted lines and stuff on the legs to go, and when they look at that dotted line and go,
ooh, that's not good.
Maybe we should put, you know, just jog it a little bit over here.
I'd have to see the tattoo. Because if it's like a tattoo on a curb and then like it cut along, you know, the line, not horizontal, the listeners can't appreciate what I'm gesturing right now. Oh.
You'll never walk.
Oh, so, not cool.
A lot of my family makes fake arms and legs for a living. That's what they do. Okay. And so I know for a fact
professionally,
that...
Professionally? For money? Okay. That's good.
Amateur.
That's an important distinction.
Amateur prosthetics. But I know for a fact that where this cut is made is hugely impactful on your ability to run, walk, etc. And so I'm curious, the surgeon, if I asked him and I said, where do you weight these two things?
Maybe,
aesthetics of this tattoo versus ability to walk. Yeah. I assume, hopefully...
I mean, I have to assume that there was a good reason to put the cut right where it was.
I know, that's because
the skin is different than the stuff underneath.
True.
That has a functional basis. So couldn't you have just, I don't know, left that last couple centimeters?
Yeah. I wonder that too. They have saved the skin?
So maybe he's got a bad sense of humor is what you're saying.
No, I think the guy has embraced it. Now he looks at it with more irony than anything, and he uses that as inspiration, but still, darn.
Yeah. I've seen the things. You know, you're supposed to mark the X on the leg that you are supposed to that you want removed. Mm-hmm. I've seen the person who was going in to get, I think, like gallbladder surgery, and on their leg it said not this leg, and then the other leg said not this one either. It's just as a reminder.
It's good to be prepared for that.
Yeah.
Well, we've come to the end of another show. I know. We've got to wait a whole nother week to do one of these.
Mm. Yeah.
If you like what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher, for goodness sake. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you want to suggest a story idea to us, leave us a message at theshortcoat.com. Do follow and talk to us on Twitter so we can all stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by this strange world we live in and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine, Student Government, and the Writing and Humanities Program.
Thanks, guys.
Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen, who Aline will not abuse anymore. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.